My name's Alicia. I'm a recovered alcoholic. This is a bit overwhelming. I'm nauseous. My head hurts. My hands are shaking. So we'll see what comes out. I want to thank Ivor and those who put this together. I think it's been, we were just saying, about a year and a half since this started going. And he had sent an email to Chris. And in the email, it asked if he knew any women speakers who might also happen to be in Al-Anon. And Chris forwarded me that email and just kind of said, "What do you think?" with a question mark. And I sent back, "Nope, don't know any." I could do these little gigs in Texas, but this was a bit much. But what an honor to be here. I am begging someone to meet me afterwards and translate what that man said, because it sounded hilarious and very good, and a good message, a good response. I'd like to know what it was. Jeez. What an amazing adventure this has been already. You people are nothing like those in the United States, and that's a compliment, by the way. From the gentleman who met us at the airport, to the ladies who talked with Al-Anon with me, the children giving me drawings. I mean, it's been an amazing experience, and I'm so glad to be here. I also fit in a couple of other 12-step rooms. As some of you know, I did the Al-Anon talks earlier today. I have alcoholism in my family and also a husband. I also qualify for a few other 12-step programs, but we won't tell you which ones those are. We'll leave that quiet. What I'm here to do today is basically just let you know how I got to this point in my life. And I'm definitely different than Chris or Myers, which I wanted to point this out. Myers lied to you when he said that Chris was the evil twin. They are both evil. Is obviously just a joke. I'm awestruck to get to show the podium with these gentlemen. So much respect, and they help so many people. I'm honored to be your sister on this deal. For me, the journey with alcoholism began at a young age of 14. And to paint you a picture of my home life at that time, it was perfect. You know, my family put me through private school for 10 years. I had a wonderfully loving mother who had five children. I had a pastor as a father, a missionary. So it was a lovely home. There was no reason that I should be feeling as miserable inside as I was at 14 years old. And when I found alcohol, I found something to treat that. I absolutely understand now that was the spiritual malady piece and the darkness that was inside. If you added alcohol to me, I was no longer full of fear. I was hilarious and everyone loved me. I was much better looking, I thought, when I was drunk. You know, all these things. I could dance better, you know. All these things. And I remember thinking consciously, I'm going to be doing this for a long time, because I found something to fill the void. And my alcoholism progressed fairly quickly. And at 17, I had transferred to a public high school. Quickly gravitated to the alcoholic, druggy crowd, you know, didn't want to hang with the nice girls, wanted to hang with this group. And at the end of my junior year in high school, I was, the boyfriend that I'd been dating for 6 months broke up with me, and I was devastated. That was high school love, you know, it was going to last forever. How many spirals has I written his name on? You know, I thought we were going to make it. And he broke up with me, and I was devastated. So the rejection, the fear, all the feelings that we have, I set out that night to blot them out, to not feel them. And I did a very good job of doing that. And at the end of the night, I hit a telephone pole, driving in a blackout, going about 45 miles an hour. And when I woke up in the hospital, I had my jaws wired shut, my arms tied down, both legs in a cast, staples down my stomach, and a trach coming out of my neck, and I had no idea what happened. I remember getting dressed to go out, and I remember waking up in the hospital, and that was it. Apparently what I'm told happened is that I came home yelling and screaming and got in my vehicle and hit a telephone pole not even 2 miles down the street. And my mother heard the ambulance. She knew it was me. And it was a pretty life-changing event. When I came to and I saw myself for the first time, you see, I bit the steering wheel with my mouth and had no seatbelt on. So I broke the palate of my mouth. Lost many teeth. Okay, I'm gonna do it. I can pop my teeth out. Some of you aren't clapping. I actually spoke in a state in Texas that apparently they don't have a lot of teeth, so when I popped it out, they did not laugh. And I was like, wish I hadn't done that. Okay. So thank you for laughing. I can pass them around later. Like, okay, so where was I? So it was a bad day for Alicia and her family. See, I was so ugly inside at that time of my life that I had used my outside to get me through life. And I had bit off my bottom lip, my cheek was ripped up to here, my nose bone and the cartilage was all broken, metal clamp inserted in my TMJ bone, and my face was just huge. And instead of saying, thank you, God, for saving my life, I turned from my wicked ways. I said, screw you. Where were you? How could you let this happen to me? And see, the God of our household that I was raised with was not a very warm and fuzzy kind of God. And so when I heard the word God, it brought fear. It didn't bring love and the things I know today. So I was angry at God, and I spent the next 9 years of my life turning my back on him and running the opposite direction. And throughout those 9 years, it's just been so much darkness. You know, those of us that battle with this disease know that there's a lot that comes with it. And after high school, ended up going to college, to a party school. They drank like I did, so I liked this school. But I began to notice at even this stage in the game that I didn't drink like other people did. You know, I would be with a group of girlfriends, and we would have plans to go out that night, and they're downstairs eating dinner before we go out. Yeah, exactly. Why would you eat before you went out? I'm upstairs chugging beers and taking shots just to get right to walk out the door, because that's what I have to do to be okay with me. So they could do what the book says, take drinks with impunity. Take a few, you know, feel a little woozy, and put it down and walk away, and yet that didn't happen with me. I knew nothing about this disease, about the phenomenon of craving, the control piece, knew nothing about it. And even at that time in my life, thought I was normal. Let me back up real quick. When I got out of the hospital after being there 3 months, my friends threw me a party for getting out of the hospital from a drunk driving car accident. You might have friends like that. And the insanity at this point in my life, the book says, given sufficient reason, can you stop drinking? Well, my sufficient reason was I almost died. And 3 months out of the hospital, face still mangled, I'm drinking and I'm doing party tricks. I'm squirting beer where the teeth are missing. I'm attaching magnets to my face where the metal clamp is. Some of you are very puzzled. The hole in my neck isn't even closed, and I'm drinking. And for me, looking back, that was a sufficient reason, and I could not quit. So at 17, I had passed into the region that there's no return to human aid. Can't control it, can't choose to stop. At 17, I'm screwed, but I keep on going. Drop out of college, it's too much school, too many classes you had to go to, not enough beer to drink, so dropped out. And entered a new phase of my life where drugs pretty much took all of me, and I meet up with he's now my ex-husband, and I said this earlier in Al-Anon, and they didn't really laugh, but Texas, they find it funny, so humor me. I call him Satan. Okay, it didn't laugh again. Anyway, he was a very dark dark soul, let's put it that way. And the book talks about making a decision based on self that places us in a position to be hurt. So at this time in my life, I signed up for this relationship with this man. And he had just gotten out of prison, 5 years straight, drug, alcohol charges. He had no job, no car, no money. And I bet some of the women in the room would have fought me for him. Because he was the biggest, I don't want to say loser, that sounds ugly. He's an alcoholic and an addict, but he had nothing. And so I signed up for this relationship thinking that I would change him. You know, I'll stop drinking so much because I'm with him. And all these crazy decisions that 5 years later, I had a knife to my wrist because I could not get away from the monster I was now married to. I couldn't quit drinking. I couldn't quit doing drugs. I couldn't even walk out my front door. And the only answer I knew was to die. I knew nothing about the 12-step programs. I knew nothing of the hope that this deal offers. I had tried the God stuff through the church scene and wanted nothing to do with it. Religion had been forced on me so much in my life that every time the word God was said, I would think about the churches I grew up in and the things that happened in those churches. And I didn't want that God life. So for me, the only thing that I knew was to die. And by the grace of God, it didn't happen. And I ended up in treatment January of 1999. And in retrospect, I can see that I had no desire to get sober. I just wanted the pain to stop. I wanted to get away from this man. I wanted to hide out and start over. And I ended up moving and living in this town where the treatment center is. And I get out of treatment and no meetings. Well, that's not true. I went to the men's halfway house meetings because they have men. And as most of you probably know, there are many things we can use to treat this void. And for me, men has always been one of them. Anyway, those were the meetings I would go to. But I had no sponsor, no steps, no freedom, dry as a bone, crawling out of my skin. And the only thing I knew to make it stop was to drink. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror and saying, okay, girl, you can drink. Just don't do drugs. Drugs was the problem. That one doesn't work. Any newcomers who are going to try it, doesn't work. But the baffling feature is that I have scars on my face from what alcohol did at 17, and that doesn't even cross my mind. This is the cunning, baffling, and powerful. So I drank that night, did drugs that night, and within 9 months, I am at a whole new level of insanity. Satan went back to prison. So I divorced him while he was staying there and met my now husband. He was living at the men's halfway house. So it paid off to go to those meetings because we got to meet there. He was in relapse. I was in relapse. He's an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. So it was another wonderful beginning to a healthy marriage. The book talks about leading the double life and being the actor, and that's exactly what I was doing. I was working at the treatment center. They had hired me there out of treatment because I was a model patient. I can put the front on very well that I'm doing okay, and so they hired me. Oops. And for 4 or 5 months, no, it actually was about 9 months, The fear of people knowing who I really was, the panic of keeping all the lies going and making sure I was not caught, it was a horrible time in my life. And thank God that at the end of a very long 3-day binge, the pain was so great. And, you know, when I went to treatment, I had lost everything. I had a trash bag full of clothes to my name. That was it. We gave everything away for alcohol and that lifestyle. And so you would think at 25, when I lost all that, that I would get sober. But absolutely not. My ego was still there. I had lost everything materially, but up here I still thought I had it all together. So I played the treatment game, then discharged, and within 9 months had reassembled everything. We do that very well. I got the house now, or the apartment, the car, the money, the boyfriend. All the material things came back. And yet this time, I was more dark inside than ever. And I remember crying out just looking up at the ceiling going, all right, fine. God, if you are even still there, I need your help. I knew I didn't want to feel this way any longer. I knew that it was just getting worse, that this was a progressive deal and it gets worse, never better. And my life definitely showed that. So somehow, I joke that God was in the room when I said that, and that he's followed me everywhere through my life. He's never let me go. It's always me that's left. And I joke that he was right there in the room, and he said, on walkie-talkie, she said it, get her, get her, get her. You know, it's like the power came down and pulled me out of that darkness somehow. Because I had made those sort of resolutions many times. This has got to stop. And then I'd be drunk the next day. And so this time, I don't know what was different. I don't know why it was different. All I know is the next day I was able to hang on and not drink and walk into my first 12-step meeting to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this room were women that their eyes were shining. They were telling stories about how their life had been changed around. They were on fire with whatever it was they had. And I was very clear, I didn't want my life anymore. So what they had to be better. And just that first meeting, because they were talking of solution, because they weren't sitting in there trying to, you know, one-up each other on who had gone the lowest, and it was none of that stuff. It was about the power of God. And even though the word God made me feel a little strange, I was willing to do whatever it took. And the book talks about being beat into a state of reasonableness. It says this can be a tedious process, and I know for me it was. I would hit a brick wall and then go, okay, now I'm ready to get sober. Then I'd drink and hit another brick wall. Okay, now I'm ready. And for some reason, this time, I was beat into that state of mind. And I thought it would have happened when I was 25, when I lost it all. But see, reasonableness takes place up here. This is where it happens. And what it looks like is, what do I have to do? I will do anything to not be this woman anymore. I was sharing in the Al-Anon meeting earlier that some of these character defects that we have, they are almost like survival skills, survival techniques that we've used to cope and go through life. And for me, dishonesty was one of them. And I couldn't tell the truth to save my life. My name means truthful one. So my parents screwed me from day one, little high expectations there at birth. So by the end of my disease, I couldn't even tell you the truth about my name. I would go to nightclubs, and when people asked me my name, I'd say, Kelly? And the reason doing that is when the next day people are talking about the psycho slut Kelly who did all this crazy stuff, I'll be like, oh, I know, isn't she sick? That was really mean. But I was so terrified that I would lie at any cost, and scared that if you really found out who I was, you wouldn't like me very much. But the women in this meeting had something I did not have. I would rather die than be Kelly anymore. So I was willing to do what they said. And that night, this woman came up to me and she said, here, you need a sponsor, and gave me her card. And I think that God knew that I was very hard-headed, and I probably would take a long time in getting a sponsor, so he sent one to me. And that began my journey, and that was January the 11th, 1999. I know that some of you have a lot more time than that, but for any of us, there's people in here with 20 days, 30 days. That's a long time. You know, it doesn't matter how many years. So as this journey began, and I knew that I could do whatever they asked me to do, and I began being willing to throw aside my old conceptions of God. I say this because there's a lady that was here twice today and heard me speak, and every time I said the word God, she came up and told me that she didn't like it. Okay. I don't know. I understand the feeling because in one of the churches that we went... No, I won't go there. Never mind. Anyway, there was a lot of bad stuff that happened to me along the way in the name of God. You know, when I was 14... This is a sad story. I was 14 and my dad took away my... Oh, y'all may not know them. Cyndi Lauper and Go-Go's. Okay, I was 14. Anyway, he took them away and burned them because they were satanic. So... I'm a little scared. If God hates the Go-Go's, we got the beat. You know, that's all they're doing. And I'm already drinking. I can't make it. I'm screwed. So what I had to do when it talks about pain to believe, you know, I had to throw out all the old concepts. I was terrified of him. It was punishing. It was keeping score. I felt like I always had to do perfect. And if I didn't, he didn't want anything to do with me. And so when I got in the rooms and saw the word God in the steps, I did the same thing. So I can understand the people that just that word might make you shut down a little bit. So for me, that one had to go out the window. And I had to come up with a whole new conception and a whole new God because my life depended on it. We agnostics talks about that to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Another part of the book says we can go on blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we know how, or accept spiritual help. Another place it says pretty much do this or else. So that's how I came to believe. The pain was so great over here, and I didn't want it anymore, that I came to believe there was a God out there who could love me and restore me to the sanity. Third step is decision. Inventory gets done. Go out and make amends. Prayer and meditation, and then the big one. But having had the spiritual awakening, now it's my turn to give it away. And this is where I finally began to understand why all those things had happened to me in my past, why I had been through all the pain and all the darkness. It was because there was going to be a girl that would walk in the meeting and get a desire chip, and she couldn't even look me in the eyes because she was so full of shame and guilt. And I remember that. I used to be there. And a woman came up to me and showed me love. So in turn, I give it away now. And I think I have 2 months sober, and God put the first sponsee in front of me. And she drank, so I thought I'd killed her. It's a little scary. I understand, though, why they say we stay sober. You know, if they relapse, that's their story. But it pulled me through the tough times, especially in early sobriety. Alcoholic number two, I don't know why there couldn't have ever been a nice Christian guy. We had to go with alcoholic one and alcoholic two. But alcoholic two and I got married when I had about a year and a half sober. And he struggled with this disease. He struggled staying sober. And he's a wonderful starter. Starts the program, gets the sponsor, gets the step, and falls, and then starts again. But when I had 2 months sober, I had these big dreams that he and I were going to sponsor couples. We would be the Alcoholic Anonymous Couple Foundation or something. I had big dreams. I would go out and save the women, and he would go save the men, you know? And he ruined that whole thing. yeah. Thank you. See, it was a good dream. It was a good story, jerk. Oops. You probably might hear this. Anyway, at 2 months sober, I came home one day from a meeting, and there were some things around our house that were missing, and so it was a clear sign to me that he was not doing well. Whenever large appliances are missing, you know they've been pawned. So, do y'all pawn things here? Yes. Oh, no one's answering. They don't. Okay. Anyway, it was in such early sobriety that I wasn't totally through the steps yet. I wasn't totally connected to God yet. I was new with this whole deal, and I had still been using my husband Shane to fill the void. So when he was out of the picture, I was devastated. I remember crying so hard that night that I fell on the ground just out of exhaustion. The pain was so fresh and so real, and I knew if I walked out that door, I was going to get loaded. I knew I was, because that's what I do. I don't feel pain. I do not like discomfort. I like to anesthetize it. And it was a terrifying spot in early recovery. But because I had done as much work as I had and began to start working with others, I fell on the ground. All I could say was help. I crawled into bed, cried myself to sleep, and woke up the next day sober. I was like, oh my gosh, it worked! You know, because that was the first one, the first trial, the first tough spot I had walked through in my sobriety, and God was already there. And that was just the beginning of many. There's been so many times that it would be a lot easier just to turn back and run. The book kind of calls it the easier, softer way. There have been many times when that might have been better, you know, so I wouldn't have to feel the pain, but I know I would not be where I am today, obviously, had I gone backwards. And so the book promises that in trials and low spots, if you just keep pressing on and work with others, you're going to be okay. And that's been my truth. On page 45 in our text, the paragraph, lack of power, that was our dilemma. When they first read that to me, I didn't understand what it meant because I had so much power in so many different areas of my life that I didn't understand how this could be true. But this was the one thing that had me beat. This was the one area that no matter how great the necessity or wish, I was still going to drink. I mean, there were days looking in the mirror crying, just going, girl, this has got to stop. I'm not even promising family members anymore. I'm promising me. And then by 5 o'clock on the drive home, I'm started again. So I understood that I obviously didn't have the power to do this, and I needed the power. And the book says that's the reason you're working the steps. Everything I'm doing in 1 through 12 is to get access to this power so that I don't have to die the alcoholic death. And I had believed in God for so long. I had so much information and knowledge from the churches or the schools that we went to, but that obviously hadn't kept me sober. I thought the fact that I wore uniforms for 10 years would count for something, but the private school education, it didn't matter. There was a lady that helped me understand this a little bit deeper. There's a channel that's there, and on one side of the channel is God or the power, and on the other side is us. And over here with us is the alcohol and the drugs, all the things we're dying to put down. And I have a strong belief in God. A lot of people believe that God's out there, but belief is not enough to get us sober. I need to get access to the power. So everything I'm doing is to clean out the middle of that channel, all the shame, guilt, depression, lies, fear, clean that out so I can finally have access. I used to think that I had access. I would go to church towards the end of my disease, go to church because I felt kind of obligated. My dad was a pastor there. And I would come in after being up the whole weekend, reeking of alcohol, but I had to show up and try to act like I had it together. And I remember just crying because I had so much shame and guilt, and I had such a strong desire to be a better woman, and I couldn't do it. And in the United States, I'm from a non-denominational background, which you might be thinking like the people that handle snakes. No, not that crazy. But the hallelujah, you know, and the dancing and jumping around, that's the kind of church we were raised in. So I would go to the altar, you know, to try to rededicate my life and change my ways. And they would pray for me and do all this stuff. And I would walk out feeling refreshed. I could have made a new start. I was ready. So I got a 12-pack of beer on the way home to celebrate my decision. And this went on many times in my life. I wanted so bad to stop this, but I had no idea how to make it happen. So when they helped me understand that I didn't have the power on my own to do that, I was willing to clean that channel out, get connected, to where the obsession would be lifted. And as long as that channel stays clear, I will never drink and drug again. Now the problem with that channel is you can get it clear, the obsession can be removed, and yet you can stop doing the things that got you in that position. At 2 years sober, 2 years sober, I was about 50 pounds pregnant, almost 200 pounds. I was huge, and I couldn't even waddle anymore. So I quit going to meetings. Their chairs were too small for my larger, and I didn't want to go anymore. So I quit going to meetings. I fired all the women I was sponsoring because I just wanted to focus on this child. This is my heart's desire to be a mother, so I'm focused on this. So now I'm not helping others. My husband is not staying sober, so I'm full of resentment and anger and fear. The big one, though, people would call to check on me, and I miss Kerrville AA, you know, my ego. I got to have it all together. So when I said that, it sounds pretty stupid. Kerrville's like this big. I don't know why I thought that was a cool thing. Anyway, so people are calling to check on me, and Alicia, are you ready for the baby? Is everything okay? Bless God, everything's great. Thanks for asking. Can't wait for the baby. Oh, yeah, we're good. Plenty of money. You know, and it's lies. Absolute lies. My ego-driven lies. I want you to think I'm okay. And so I will put that front up so you don't really know who's back here. these fear masks that we wear so well. You know, throughout my whole high school, I would change the mask with whatever group I was with. When I got to college, I joined. We have sororities in the United States. I don't know if you have them, but basically a bunch of girls that party a lot. And there's some other things they do, but that's all I knew. Anyway, I jumped in with that group. And see, this is where I don't know if things are funny in your country. But sorority over there, the girls are very like this. Oh my God, thanks so much, you know? And very fake. And so I jumped right in because they drank. I was terrified to be alone, so here I wore that mask. And then I do one more switch. You know, I'm a big, you know, drug addict now, and I can't go to the drug dealer's house wearing my sorority mask. Oh my God, can I have some cocaine? You know? I have to leave that mask alone and pick up the, yo, what's up? Give me some. You know, I gotta put the thug mask on. And my whole life, I just gripped with these. And switching. And what a terrifying, miserable place to be. And yet it was all I knew. So as these begin to fall, the masks begin to fall, I get closer and closer to this power. I find out who I really am. And come to find out I'm just a big dork. I mean, really? Dork? What does that translate to? Idiot? Is that better? Okay. Anyway, I'm not very complex. There's nothing to really hide, and I'm okay with me today. You know? I don't live in constant fear of what you're going to think about me. I still battle it, I guess, as we all do sometimes, but it's not as paralyzing as it used to be. As this journey has gone on, there's been so many women that have come in and out of my life seeking a solution, and I never had anything to offer anyone before. The only thing they might have wanted from me was alcohol or my man or something, you know. And today, these women were coming into my life because they were dying from this disease and they needed help. Spider-Man. Sorry, there's Spider-Man down here. I'm not. Never mind. Okay. I'll go on. The disease cycle that the book talks about, in the doctor's opinion, you know, it talks about how everything that starts this deal off is inside. The irritable, restless, discontented nature, full of fear, gripped with misery and depression. And that's how it all begins. And I knew that feeling well. You know, waking up in the morning after a long night of drinking and kind of coming to, rather, and looking around. Oh, this is not good. You know, you're seeing things thrown everywhere. Someone's downstairs slamming cabinets and says, uh-oh. But waking up with the hideous four horsemen, the book calls them terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. And I knew those on a daily basis, from eyes opening as reality was setting in, that the darkness that was inside was almost too much. And so then the mental piece, the mind piece of this comes in. This is the obsession. This is the thing that I can't shut up on my own. From 14 to 26, I either had alcohol and drugs in my body or I thought about getting alcohol and drugs in my body, and these voices would not be quiet. And so the only thing I knew at the time to treat this darkness was the alcohol. So even though I had just promised my boss that this would not happen again, or even though I had promised my family that I will be back, I'll make it to the birthday, I'd made all these promises. When it came down to the obsession, this is what won. It was almost as if a robot to this disease, like, must have beer, you know, just following what this is saying. And it was so frustrating because there were so many times I did not want to get drunk. So many times that this was not fun anymore. Strong desire to be daddy's little girl and absolutely no power to do it. I understand now that this is the no choice piece. You know, we don't have the power of choice. We lost that a long time ago. The only choice I do have is to seek for power or not. And if I choose or not, then all bets are off and here I go again. So from the mind, it comes to the body, to the third piece of this deal. My mind says, let's have a drink, and I say, okay. So I take the first one, and now I'm really screwed because I'm wired different than normal people. I have a craving that kicks off that does not happen in the normal drinker. I can't control it once I start. And see, my disease didn't say, let's drink for 3 days, get in a blackout, hurt a lot of people, and spend all your money. Okay? My disease did not say that. They said, let's have a couple of beers and go dancing. What's it gonna hurt? Come on, you can do this. So I would do it and pass through the stages of a spree. Wee! I get in drunk driving car accidents in my sprees. I had this one lady at the hospital we work at say that she gets, I don't know how to translate this, but I'll try. We have fast food restaurants in the United States. You just drive through. And she said that she got a DWI in the Taco Bell line because she was ordering and she passed out. And they had to call the cops to come get her removed, so she got a DWI, which is driving while intoxicated. Technically, she wasn't driving, though. You know, she was ordering. So I think that's a little rough. But what happens, though, is when we go through these sprees, we come out on the end, and the book says we emerge remorseful. Absolutely. As I was saying, the opening the eyes and seeing what's going on, reality sinking in, and it's terrifying. And I make the resolution not to do it again. Never. I promise this is it. Have you made those promises before? Yes, very often. And a couple of hours sometimes I could do really well, you know, but pretty soon I forget that I just promised someone. So what happens now is I'm full of guilt and shame and fear because of all the things that I did in this spree. And what do you know? I'm right back in the spiritual malady. The dark hole inside me is bigger. And I might be able to hang on for a day or two, but eventually what's going to happen is I can't stay untreated like this. It's either going to be alcohol, drugs, men, shopping, sex, food. Okay, there's a lot of things that can treat it, but it's either going to be one of those or it's going to be a power greater than me. That's it. Because I can't stay untreated very long. I don't like the way it feels to not... I don't like the way it feels to feel. Let's put it that way. So this cycle that we get stuck in, it goes on and on. And the book says, unless we can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for my recovery. So that meant that I had to get a connection with this power sufficient enough to overcome alcoholism and addiction. And the journey that I was on in 1 through 12 is what they promised me would do it. In the back of our books on page 567, it appendices 2, it describes the spiritual experience. And what it calls it that I love so much, it calls it a profound alteration in your reaction to life. So what that meant is, for me, being selfish and self-centered and manipulating and controlling, I would do this work and change to an unselfish, giving, caring person. The absolute liar that I was becomes willing to be honest at any cost. That was a huge one for me. As I shared, it's been a long time, this lying of mine, and now this is such a serious piece for me that I have to be honest about even the little things. So let's say I lie to you about something, but I'm sober, I'm doing well, I lie to you about something, and I have to come up to you then and say, don't know why I said that. I've never been to Cancun. You know, stupid little lies like that, you would think it'd be no big deal. But what will happen now is you will ask me, oh, you've been to Cancun, where did you stay? There's a lot of water and some beds and this hotel. I can't remember the name. How much did you pay? And I have one lie. One ego-driven lie now has 4 or 5 to back it up. And what do you know? If I'm not careful, Kelly will come back. And we don't want that. Texas is much happier than Alicia is standing forward. So the dishonest becomes honest. The angry and intolerant becomes patient and loving. Picking up trash that's not mine. Is that really a big deal? For me, it is. Because I would chug a tall boy on the way home every day from work and chunk it out the window. Couldn't care less in my disease. So to think about that and to pick it up, that's a profound alteration in the way I react to life. Some of you just saying please and thank you instead of give it to me now or something like that. That can be how you're reacting different. This hospital that I have the pleasure and the honor to work at, so many people come to talk to me and they say that they don't feel that they've changed. They don't feel... Oh, okay. They don't feel that he is not drunk. Somebody just did that. That's not true. Someone tripped him. Someone down there said that. I didn't say that. Okay, they come to talk to me about about the spiritual experience piece, and they feel that if they're not feeling the warm fuzzies, you know, and floating and just feeling the presence, if they're not that, then they haven't gotten a connection with God yet. And the book talks about sudden and spectacular upheavals, that some people burning bush experience, that the bush talks to you and now you're sober. But that's not the norm. I have not seen anyone do that. There was one patient at our hospital that lit a cedar twig on fire and said, "Talk to me!" Burning bush. Anyway, it didn't work. Some of you that are writing that down, and it doesn't work. So instead of looking for the changed just like that, now I have healing hands and I drink no more, that didn't happen. We have the educational variety that develops slowly, the book says, over a period of time. So begin looking for those things, especially you guys in early sobriety, the ones that are the most important in here. You've already begun to change. If you're doing some service work here at this conference this weekend, that's not how you used to be. I could care less. And if you're signing up and helping, God is there. You know, that the change has begun to start. And it's just the beginning. Our taxi service, this gentleman that's been, you know, going around, taking us different places here and there. We've had a couple taxis, actually. We lived through all of them. That was funny. It was very scary driving, but Myers and Chris are laughing because they know what I'm talking about. Anyway, not even 30 days sober and coming to pick us up, coming to do some service work, you know, making coffee back here. All you guys that are involved in this, it's huge. That is not who we usually are, or at least I wasn't. And the book says selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. So for me to be unselfish and care about you and how you're doing and serve coffee and help others, that's a profound alteration in my reaction to life. So begin looking for those things. Now, so many people, they'll do that. They're expecting that something's going to change just like that, and now they're going to be internally different, and nothing's ever the same. And that wasn't my experience. It's been a very long educational variety. and sometimes I wish I would quit learning, but that's not an option I have today. I've chosen to go towards this path. I've chosen to let God walk me through the tough times. I've made a commitment for good and for all to not be this woman anymore. And every time something comes up, my experience from that 2 months sober to today, standing up here and doing this, God has been there. And it didn't matter where I've been or what I've done. It didn't matter. This love that I found from this power greater than me, it came in and changed my life. I was sharing about the steps that I took away from the program when I was pregnant. Stopped meetings, stopped sponsoring, full of resentment, dishonest. And it got to a place so bad that my husband was not staying sober, and my son is laying in the crib next to me. This is my heart's desire, to be a mother. But because I've spent so many days going away from the light that I need to stay sober, 2 months have gone by, I haven't done anything. And the thought crosses my mind, how come he gets to drink and I don't? You know? That was a little scary. Who said that? Kelly? Where'd that come from? But it was because day after day after day, I had chosen not to seek the light. So for us, complacency or non-action is really an action. It takes you backwards, you know? We don't just stay stagnant and stay at the level we are. We will if we are not progressing. And so everything I'm doing throughout the day, when I got up this morning, did I do something to get me connected to the God of my understanding? Yes. So there's a step towards the light. Throughout the day, tried to carry a message of hope and talk in the Al-Anon meetings. That was being of service. There's just another step towards the light. And all day long, I can look at this and see, am I going forwards or am I going backwards? And the bedevilments on page 52 are a wonderful checklist to see how I'm doing. You know, full of fear, trouble with personal relationships, unhappy, can't be of real help to other people. If I'm seeing that these are happening in my life, I better get busy and get back towards the light. Which, by the grace of God, when that thought came, I cried out for help. I got on my knees. I called my sponsor. I got to a meeting and quickly ran, you know, towards the light. And here we are 3.5 years later. Thank God. Because I know, had I not done that and just sat in that feeling with those thoughts coming in, pretty soon the full spiritual malady would have returned. The obsession would have come back and I would have been gone. Both my son's parents would have been out drinking. And I'm so grateful that that didn't happen. And just like I said, from 2 months sober to 2.5 years sober to now almost 6 years sober, every situation that I've come up against that seemed too great, that I couldn't handle it, couldn't do it on my own, the power has shown up and walked me through. I guess when I speak, it's more of that there's a lot of different points that I wish to make, and I probably missed most of them, but I guess the theme of what God is working on with me today is that there is nothing out here that can change or fix what's wrong in here. And the little issue man and issue woman and issue clown now, poor guy, what do you do? I can have anything going on outside. I can have things falling all around me, but if I keep doing what I need to do, this hole will stay treated with the power, and I will never have to seek anything else out here to do that. And over and over and over again, God has proven that to be true in my life. There's a spot in the book that says, it says something really good. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. Now, that was a huge promise for me. And in my first big book, I had Crisis Junkie written next to that paragraph because in the face of collapse and despair, I thrived. You know, I was a wonderful martyr, an excellent victim. And when things were falling apart, perfect excuse to get loaded. Perfect excuse to block this out. And my family would go, poor thing. You see what she's been through. I now have passed on the Al-Anon salute to your Denmark. This is the Al-Anon salute. Oh, my. Yeah. In early sobriety, my sponsor, because I'm a huge victim, and the book says there's a spot, it says, he begins to think life doesn't treat him right, and that was me, everything for me. And my sponsor used to say, Alicia, your V is flashing, because I would say, I can't believe he did this, victim, you know? Because if I can blame you for what's wrong in here, what a cool deal. I don't have to grow up. I don't have to accept responsibility for my life. I can blame it on you and keep drinking. So that was a tough one to let go of. Because it worked. But I got my way. I got attention. I didn't have to be honest. You know, there were some things that I got out of playing that role, or I wouldn't have done it for so long. And today, my sponsor, she called me a victim not too long ago, and I was so offended because I had put my V down for a while and didn't see myself like I used to be, so I didn't understand. But she said, this definition was blaming something out here for what's wrong with me in here. That was a whole new victim role, and oh my gosh, since she brought that to my attention, it's everywhere, you know? I can't believe what they've done. I'm so angry. I'm so scared. How could he do this? I'm blaming out here for what's going on here. I can't change my past or my family or my husband or my son. I can't do anything about them. So the only thing I can do is to change me. So many freeing things that come from this program, to drop all these old ways and begin something new. You guys that are new in this room, you are the most important person here. What an honor to get to speak here in Denmark. I'm extremely overwhelmed, very tearful, was crying a lot right before this, because how did I get here? You know, I lost everything at 25 years old to alcohol and drugs, and today, almost 6 years later, I'm a mother to an incredible 3.5-year-old son. We just bought a house in May. I'm in Denmark, for goodness sakes. And It's just amazing. I don't understand how he did it. I mean, I understand that if you work 1 through 12, this will happen. But it still doesn't make sense. Because only we know who we used to be in our disease. So only we really can, ooh, you know. I knew that Kelly was a mess. She did terrible things that got us in a lot of trouble. And, oops, sorry. And so today to be changed from the inside and not be that woman anymore, I don't get it. But I know that I've done this work this long, and I believe that the more I keep putting into this, the more I'm going to continue getting out of it. My favorite promises in the big book are on page 57 in our book, and they say, but he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. So those are my favorite, but they're conditional. He has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. God could and would if he were sought. If you seek him, he can and he will. If you don't, you just get what you got before. So these have been the underlying promises and the things that I have found in this deal. The more I push forward, the more I go forward, the more he's going to show up and continue to change my life from the inside. Unfortunately, the story with Alcoholic 2 has been a difficult deal, and he has continued to struggle staying sober. And thank God for Al-Anon. I believe it saved my sobriety, because as I said, about 2.5 years sober, the thoughts were beginning to come about drinking, and it was because I was so obsessed on him and where he was and where the money was and hiding the money, and I was so obsessed on him that God, my higher power, it wasn't that. Anything I put before God in this program, I would lose. So here, I had been focusing on him and where he was and what he was doing. God's back here going, hello, wait a minute, you and I were doing good, but I'm so focused on my husband, I can't see that. So thank God for the rooms of Al-Anon. I am now what we call in the States a double winner. Yay. I definitely prefer that instead of really, really sick. Double winner sounds much happier. So many, many times of doing things wrong, you know, with my husband and doing, I was the tough Al-Anon who would say, no, you sleep in your car. Here's a blanket. Very tough. He couldn't sleep inside, but I'd feed him in his car and I'd give him a blanket. And I found that what I was addicted to was him saying, please, I love you. I want to be here with you guys. I want to try again, please. And that is all I would have to hear, and I would be right back. And I really thought I had the right motives. I thought it was this unconditional love, and I think it happened as long as it needed to. You know, and many nights I would ask God for me to hear his will and let me see what he wanted, not what I wanted. And he would show me, and I would go, la la la, the other will. No, 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 not that one. The one where I get what I want. That's the one I want to hear. And so because of not following his guidance many times, the pain, it's been amazing. And just recently had to make the decision that we needed to divorce and go our separate ways. So I filed for divorce in September, and I love this idiot. I hate his disease. I love him, but I don't want to be affected by it anymore. And my son has been affected. The confusion. Last year, Shane went to treatment for a while, and my son bit his way out of daycare. He got kicked out of his first school. We're in trouble. But it was the only way that a 2.5-year-old knows how to express confusion and pain. And he was affected many times by me being so distracted with the shame and the money and the fear that I would either neglect or shout at him. And so this time, with this decision, I don't really have a choice in the matter. And for the first time, well, that's not true, I do. I could go back and stay for more, you know. But I can't imagine this pain has been has been God's will, and it took me this long to get beat into this state of mind where I was ready to let him go. This is the first time that he's never begged me to let him stay. And that's, I don't know how to react to that, you know? He knows that he's going to die if we don't do something different. And I'm going to pray that. So as cliche as the phrase is, I love him enough to let him go. These things that we go through in sobriety and that we walk through, there's no way I can do this right now with this going on at home. There's no way. I had to leave him with my son, and I didn't have to. My parents don't live there. I had no one else to keep him in, and he's sober now. He just got out of treatment again. He has about 90 days, and he's doing all the stupid things he would never do when he was with me. It's like, you know, anyway, my sponsor said it's because I got out of the way, apparently. I don't agree with that. You were not supposed to clap there. You're supposed to be on my side. But absolutely, how many times did my husband begin to cry out to God? And he didn't have to, because God, Alicia, said, come on back. Here's some food, here's some money, and a place to sleep. Why would he cry out for God if I'm in the way? You know, and as I said, this was not trying to kill him. Well, usually it wasn't trying to kill him, but I had the right motive behind it, you know. But anyway, this is what God is walking me through now, and I left him at home with our son, the keys, in my house. He's been living with his parents. And normally, that would be something that would paralyze me. Constant fear. Oh my God, what's going to happen? You know, biting my nails, which I kind of still do that. But headaches, stomach pain. I mean, this blockage from God affects me physically. I mean, I start to take on fear in physical forms. And I'm not there today. I'm standing here in Denmark giving a talk about the power of God. And that's what I do, you know. I continue to show up and do what he wants me to do. And as I continue carrying his message, he takes care of me. Because that's how the whole deal works. See, if I think about you and what's going on with you, you will think about God, and God will take care of me. I think about you. Secret handshake, there it is, you know. Go shake someone else's hand, you know. Go try to help someone else and start to see just how amazing it is. This divorce, there have been many times that I could sit at home in my house that I can't afford on my own now. A little scary. I'm feeling sorry for myself. Poor me, you know, single mother. None of my friends have children, so I do this a lot. But I could be sitting at home doing that, wallowing in my self-pity, and the phone will ring, and it's one of the girls that I sponsor. She's in early sobriety, has no job, no money, no car, cannot stand the sober house she's living in, and she's terrified. And what happens if I take the time to talk to her and what's going on in her life and try to help her, what do you know, by the time I hang up the phone, What was I upset about? I mean, it's gone. And that's how it works. If I think about them and try to stay close to them, then God's going to take care of me. And it's been working for almost 6 years. And I bet it's going to work for a long time. This is the gift of the deal. This is what this whole conference and this passion is about. That there's a solution. You know? So many people die from this before they hear that. So how wonderful that they've put this together, so you have no excuse. You are armed with the facts now, and carry those facts and help other people and watch them catch fire. A couple of times this afternoon, I've met a sponsor, and I've met the person they sponsor, and the person they sponsor, and the person they sponsor. And that is, you know, chills. That's how it works. You continue to pass the torch, and this weekend the torch has been passed to you. As Meyer said, if you didn't understand the torch because we were talking too fast, get the CD, figure out what the torch was, and pass that on. I thought that was very funny. I thought that went well. But that's what it's all about, the secret handshake, the solution, why we're even here. It doesn't matter who went lower. It doesn't matter who drank this or blacked out this or who got arrested. It doesn't matter. Inside, we are all the same, empty, without some sort of power in our life. So the access comes from these steps. If you haven't felt the change, if you have not experienced this yet, get busy. That's why they talk about doing this quickly. Why would I want to wait 3 months to feel better? You know, it just doesn't happen. So get busy. I usually end all my talks with this. Last year in February, I gave my father a CD of a talk that I did. In fact, it was the talk that Ivor got to hear. And see, my dad is Mr. Missionary, so he saves a lot of souls for Jesus. And I don't do that. And I didn't know how he was going to react to, since I'm not doing it as he thinks I should. Anyway, there was some fear about doing this. And see, throughout my life, Dad and I didn't hang out a lot, because here he is saving souls for Jesus, and here I am, possessed girl, doing this stuff. And so we didn't really hang out a lot. So this program has given me back the relationships with my family members that I thought were gone. And what do you know? I'm 31 years old, but I'm Daddy's little girl finally. There's a line in the book that says, "At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed." I wanted so bad to be someone that my father could be proud of, that my mother would be honored to say that's my daughter. But in my disease, I couldn't do it. So today, it's possible. And I gave my dad this CD, and he gave it back to me. Well, he listened to it. That sounded like he was very rude. He listened to it and gave it back to me. And his ministry is music. He writes Christian music. And he just put out a Christian CD that I got to sing back up on. It was fun. No big deal. But he hands me the CD back, and he says, "Alicia, God wants you to write some songs about what you've been through in your life. I will put it to music, and we'll get it recorded." Sure, you know, I mean, we have music talent in our family, but I don't sing a lot in the shower, you know, in the car. I've never written anything, and I have no money. So I figured, phew, I'm out of that one. But that's not how this power I know works, because doors begin to poof, fly open. You know, the producer who did my dad's CD wanted to do this project free, because he had alcoholics in his family, and he knew that this would be carrying a message through song. So I sat down one night, and I wrote a poem, because I don't know how to write songs. And any of you musicians in here, you would have laughed, because I'm sitting in front of the computer going, da 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 da. Yeah, that's good. I have no idea. I'm using the rhyming dictionary and the thesaurus. Can't ever say that word. Anyway, I totally no idea what I'm doing. But what happened is, at the end of the night, I'm weeping. Because I didn't write this. You know what I mean? I mean, I did, but where the words came from? How did this get put together? And the poem's called Scars. And for me, it's some external scars, some things that I wear out here, a sign of my disease. Some of you have those. But then not only that, but the internal scars. The darkness and the pain that only we know about. The memories that we carry. And in this poem, I'm asking God. It says, I ask God why all these things took place. Things that changed me forever and caused such disgrace. His answer came clear. The tears began to lift. My child, those scars are your greatest gift. With my power behind you, we will change lives together. Trust me, keep seeking, and I'll leave you never. If you understood that, will you say yes?
Yes.
Okay, shoot. I've been practicing. There's a spot in the book, it's my favorite. In the family afterwards, in our book, it's 124. But it says, this painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, Each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Here it is. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. So this is the closing sentence, whatever. Everything you've been through in your life, from that first dark day to the last one, to today, right now, everything, God can use it. There's a purpose. There was a reason I can see now that I got in that car accident. Because I get to work with teenagers at our hospital who think that, you know, they can drive drunk and it's no big deal. And I can pop my teeth out and tell them it's not true. And this... So many of us get so bogged down with poor me, why did this happen to me, and current things we go through in sobriety, where are you, God, you know, and all this stuff we do. There's a purpose, there's a reason. Get to the other side, use it to help someone else and we'll understand. And I know that this divorce right now, I know that everything I've been through, God uses to help others. And though sometimes I'm tired of getting used, I'm willing. And the benefits on the other side far outweigh the pain and the darkness that the event actually caused. So look at these things as your gift, your greatest asset. This is going to freak you out. I'm going to sing the chorus. They do have some announcements to make afterwards, so please do not leave. I want to thank you. Oh, that sounded bad for me. I want to thank you all for your hospitality. You are incredible people, and you have a gift and a heart of love for others. Continue to spread that around your area here, and you're just amazing, and I'm so honored. Okay, of course, my last bit of water. And I'm going to sing this very slow. It's a little different with 20 people. Okay. So now with God's power, all the scars make sense. My spirit protected, I have found my defense. There is hope for you, 'cause there was hope for me. And He'll walk you through it. Believe that you're set free from the battle deep inside, and it's more than you can bear, and you're crying out for comfort, finding nothing there. There is hope for you, 'cause there was hope for me, and He'll walk you through it. Believe. Oh, you can be free. Thank you.